Hi, it's me, Claire Sawyer, here again, the programmer for young readers here at Adelaide Writers Week. Thank you for hanging around. You are officially my favourite people that I've met at Adelaide Writers Week. Thanks so much for being here. I am so delighted tonight to have two fabulous authors having an in conversation together. It's so wonderful to be able to welcome South Australian author Vicky Wakefield in conversation with one of my absolute favourite authors at this moment in time, and it's Gary Lonesborough. I want to tell you, yay! I want to tell you a little bit about them both, but you also will have an opportunity to ask them questions as well, to ask Gary any questions. We're going to have a microphone set up here, and we'll throw to questions after Vicky's had her conversation with Gary. But let me tell you a little bit about Vicky. She writes fiction for adults and young adults. Her novels have been shortlisted for numerous awards. After You Were Gone, a psychological thriller, was her first novel for adults and was published in 2022 to much acclaim. To the River is her second psychological thriller for adults. And in fact, Vicky was telling me that it came out this week.
Last week.
So really, please. I know Vicky's work very well, particularly from her young adult work as well, and This Is How We Changed the Ending, which was an award-winning YA piece. And so it's great to have her in conversation with Gary. And let me tell you a little bit about Gary. So Gary Lonesborough is a Yuin writer who grew up on the far south coast of New South Wales as part of a large and proud Aboriginal family. Growing up, a massive Kylie Minogue and North Queensland Cowboys fan, Gary was always writing as a child and continued his creative journey at film school. Gary has experience working in Aboriginal health, the disability sector and the film industry. And we're very proud to have Gary here talking to us on Kaurna land. Thanks both for being here.
Thank you, Claire. And welcome, Gary, to Adelaide Writers Week. It's really great to talk to you. Thank you all for hanging around. I know it's a sticky night, but how amazing is this festival? Gary's 2021 debut novel, The Boy from the Mish, is a queer Indigenous YA novel, and it's set in a rural Australian community. And it's about 17-year-old Jackson, who's finding his way, navigating friendship, love, in a small town. This book went on to be shortlisted for the 2022 CBCA Book of the Year for Older Readers. It's was shortlisted for Victorian Premier's Literary Awards for Indigenous Writing, New South Wales Premier's Literary Award Indigenous Writers Prize, Queensland Literary Awards, this is seriously impressive, and our own Adelaide Festival Young Adult Fiction Award. So that's your first book. And then your second novel, We Didn't Think It Through, is a compelling coming-of-age novel about Jamie Langton finding his future, navigating the challenges of racism, family, friendship in a small town. Now, this just last week was longlisted for the CBCA Book of the Year. So, Gary, you look pretty set to continue your success. And the judges said it's a confronting and realistic book, highlighting important issues of ongoing racism and prejudice towards Aboriginal youth and the challenges of the youth justice system. This book is a powerful and compelling read. So congratulations. Welcome to Adelaide Writers Week. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your background and what it was like when you were growing up. Was there a particular point when you wanted to be a writer?
Yeah, well, first of all, was that a riz at Kylie Minogue before? Yeah, I guess, so I grew up in Bega on the far south coast of New South Wales. If you know the Bega cheese, that's where that comes from.
Yep, we do.
I guess, yeah, growing up in a small country town, I went to a Catholic primary school. So I was raised up in the whole Catholic get-up. I guess I started really falling in love with writing around the time I was in year three, when I was about eight, 9 years old. I had a year three teacher who was a Canadian teacher on exchange at our school, and she got us to write these Halloween stories for Halloween. So these short, scary stories, And I wrote this story about me and my friends going on a school camp, and we get attacked by like werewolves and mummies and vampires in the Australian bush. And all my friends died in horrible ways in the story, and my teacher loved it, and she got me to read it in front of the class. And yeah, that was the first time I could kind of see the power that comes with writing. So I was watching my classmates kind of rolling on the ground laughing, and could hardly get to the end of the story because we're all laughing so much. Yep. And yeah, the same school, I had this really great year six teacher who I guess kind of saw that I had a kind of flair for writing. It had kind of been, you know, the teachers before her kind of building me up in a way that, to say that I was a good writer in class and telling my parents that I had some kind of talent for writing. And in year six, my teacher got me to do these little writing classes with another teacher whose name was Gabby Stroud, and she's actually an author with the same publisher as me. So I'd go out of class like one Friday every week, and we'd do little writing games and writing exercises. And I had a story published in the end of year school magazine, which was about a boy and his dad on this boat, and the boat's sinking and there's like sharks in the water and he has to get back to land. So from that point on, I kind of became known as the writer, I guess, out of my friend group. And at the end of year six, that same teacher gave me a Christmas card. So she gave all of us Christmas cards with these kind of personalized messages in them. And in my one, she said to send her a copy of my first novel. So that was kind of the catalyst, I guess, that really made me think about becoming an author one day. So I knew I loved writing.
The question we're going to ask now is, did that happen? Did you get to send your book?
No, I didn't send it, but she did come to my book launch that I had in Bega. And so she purchased a copy with her own money.
Aww.
And I got to sign it and we got a photo, and it was a pretty lovely moment, actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think she'd retired, like she was 3 years retired at that point, something like that. But she still looked exactly as I remembered her. It's like, I feel like teachers never change their appearance.
That's probably true.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess that's kind of my background and how I kind of became interested in becoming a writer one day was because of the support of those teachers, really.
And so, yeah, and the encouragement that you get as a kid when you're told that you're good at something, it goes a long way, doesn't it? To giving you the drive and the ambition to actually try really hard at something. I think if you get the stuffing knocked out of you early, a lot of talented writers might give up. I know I would have. That note, how did you get the stuffing knocked out of you any early in the piece? It's a difficult road to publication normally. What did your journey look like?
For Boy from the Mish, yeah.
Yeah, as you go from, you know, the slush pile, which can be a towering pile of manuscripts in the corner of a publisher's office and everyone skirts around it, you know, it can take a while to be discovered that way. Was that how your writing was discovered?
Yeah, I guess I'd been working on this story for a while, maybe like 2 years I'd been working on this story. For those who've read the book, who haven't read the book, it's about a boy named Jackson who meets a boy named Thomas and begins to fall in love with him. So my original draft of that story, Thomas was the main character, and he was actually a visiting tourist to the place where Jackson lives. I thought it was amazing. I thought it was the best thing I'd ever written. I decided to just send it out to a few different publishers that were accepting unsolicited manuscripts. Got a couple of rejections, but one of those rejections actually came from Alan and Unwin, who ended up publishing the book. And the editor who rejected me, wrote this really lovely email that really didn't feel like a rejection. It was very encouraging and kind of pointed out that there's a lot of really good stuff there, but that the character wasn't that interesting. And so I started kind of thinking about the story in Jackson's point of view, because Jackson was this kind of dark, mysterious character who, you know, seemed like trouble, but actually had a really, really sweet spot inside. And that wasn't really that evident in that Thomas draft. So I knew that there was something there in this story that I really wanted to tell. and it just wasn't there yet. So I tried rewriting the book from Jackson's perspective, the same story, and I found out about 10,000 words into that that wasn't going to work. So what I had to do was basically rewrite the manuscript from scratch. So it was a whole new story, really, from Jackson's perspective. I think there were maybe two or three scenes that stayed from that first version of the story. About 6 months later, I emailed that same editor and said, "Oh, hey, I've written this new version of the manuscript. I think it's much better. Would you be interested in reading it?" And she said yes. And so I just sent it to her. And months and months later, I got an email saying that a publisher wanted to meet with me. It was really, I guess I didn't really understand what the slush pile was when I first submitted my manuscript. That it's actually this massive...
where books go to die.
Yes, exactly. And like that there were so many other books in there, and that there's just these like editors that are going through all these different manuscripts and I guess, you know, weeding out the bad weeds. It was a lot of waiting. I found something I didn't know before going into it was how long I'd have to wait between emails. It was probably like it was at least 6-7 months between submitting it and hearing anything back from that first version, and then
then
probably another 6 months before I got that email saying that the publisher wanted to meet with me. It was a lot of waiting, I guess, a lot of self-doubt, which is something that we deal with anyway. So
it is. We have to deal with it, and we have to. I don't know. There's no way around it, is there? Really?
No.
There's a lot of time with yourself.
Still now.
So I'm interested in this as a queer Aboriginal coming out story. That's a lot to cover. And it's a story that should have been told before, and it hasn't. Why do you think that is?
Oh, that's a good question. Just quick sidetrack. I recently watched this movie called American Fiction, which is about this black writer in America who writes these kind of intelligent fiction stories. And as a joke, he writes this really stereotyped, kind of black story that he thinks that the publishers want. And it becomes really successful and makes him a lot of money as a joke. And I think similar to that, I think for a long time, the publishing industry in Australia was very much dominated by, you know, white people. I think publishers thought readers wanted those kind of stereotype stories, the very surface level characters of, you know, that kind of feature, stories that feature Aboriginal people. Those characters were always very stereotyped and very one dimensional. So I think that might be why these kinds of stories weren't published a long time ago.
Sure.
Because the publishers thought that the readers wanted these different versions. I think they were kind of scared of the truth and the reality of what it's like to be an Aboriginal person, what it's like to be a queer Aboriginal person. I also feel very lucky that I had my book, that I'd sent my book at the time I did.
Yep.
I do think that, you know, I was right in the middle of this kind of own voices movement in publishing, and it was a story about a gay Aboriginal kid, which was very out of the left field. So I do feel there was an element of luck involved in getting that published.
I think there was a lot of talent involved, actually. You just these both books are beautifully written, and I think that honesty that comes from being vulnerable is really apparent. Did you find that? Well, I find that when I'm writing my young adult books in particular, that I go through a period of self-reflection that can be quite painful. And I also feel kind of exposed when that book comes out, because it comes from a place of my truth. I live this. It's not me making up a story. It's actually more fact than fiction. So how did this, particularly The Boy from the Mish, when it came out, I mean, there was nothing like it out there. Did you feel vulnerable in any way?
Yeah, definitely. I think because you're just sitting with the manuscript for so long, like I was sitting with this book for years and really just putting everything on the page that everything that was very personal to me. There were a lot of versions of Jackson's inner monologue in the story that I had to kind of scale back a little bit because it was very much me. I know it sounds cliche, but it is like you're bleeding on the page in a way. There was so much of myself in Jackson. In a way, I was just kind of freshly had come out at that point that I started writing that story. So, there were a lot of things that I was still dealing with. I was still learning how to be happy with who I was, which is very much Jackson's struggle in this story. A lot of those kind of moments. There's a moment in the book where Jackson's walking on the beach and he's trying to convince himself that he's got to be straight, like he can't be gay in this place, in this small village. And like, there's no positive coming from him being gay if he makes that choice. And that's definitely a conversation I've had with myself a million times. I think I kind of, wrote the book, went through the whole publishing process, and I'd started to feel really good about it. Then about 3 months before the book came out, I had this full-on panic attack that, oh my God, like, all these people are going to read this story. People I used to go to school with are going to see on, like, Facebook or something that I'd written this book about this gay kid, and they're going to know that I'm gay. And, what are my family going to think of this, that whole struggle? I definitely had that panic, and I think the only way I kind of got over it was to remind myself that this book is something special to me, and you should share the things that are special to you, I think.
And something that you've worked so hard on, and it also, if you've written this story that is about a kid finding his authentic self and acceptance and all the rest of it, and then when you get to the end of that and you're actually ready to publish the book and you're questioning that of yourself, that must have been really tough.
Yeah. I was like, for a week straight, I was just like, oh my God, like, is it too late to pull out of this? Even though like all the arcs had been printed and we'd already sold the rights deal to like America and Audible and I was just like, oh, like I really can't, and I nearly dropped the F-bomb. I was just like, I can't do this. I was just really scared. And it was actually another YA author, Wilka Starkus, who kind of reached out early on and to offer advice and a bit of guidance as I was publishing my first book. And a lot of the things that he kind of said to me in that Google Meet video call that we had, really kind of helped me to get through that panic phase. I was very reassured, like, the day the book came out, that my dad was actually more excited than I was about the book coming out. So, I know I'm rambling on a little bit, but it also feels like you're going into the closet again in a way, or like you're just about to come out again for the first time. So that was another thing. It was like all those same feelings came back, and I was bearing my story out to whoever reads it. It was a very terrifying thing.
So if it's terrifying the first time, what's it like the second time? I mean, as writers, the first book we can often write and feel like it's a very personal thing. It's just you and the page. There's you can hold it close for a lot longer than you can with your second novel. But the second time when you write a book, A, you've got to find something else to write about. And we tend to write about similar things over and over and over, and I have to find a different way to tell the same story. If you're writing the second time, you're much more aware that your readership has expanded. You have readers out there, you have editor, you have your publisher, you have critics. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's going on that you just weren't aware of the first time around. How did you find the experience of writing the sophomore novel?
Well, I made a very good decision to start writing pretty much as soon as I got my contract for the first book. So I'd basically done my first draft of the book before The Boy from the Mish came out. I think I actually sent it to my publisher like the day before the release date or something. I know another worry I had kind of after getting my book contract, was being pigeonholed as the guy who writes about gay Aboriginal characters, who writes YA stories about gay Aboriginal people. And I kind of had this other character growing in my head for a while. So I guess I kind of just used that momentum of the euphoria I felt after getting that book deal, that I kind of used that to just propel me to write the second manuscript. So I did my first draft. I found the editing process was a lot harder, just because I was a much bigger... I was talking about much more kind of specific issues, and it definitely feels kind of like an issues book to me. That I had a lot of things I wanted to say, but the way I'd written them in the first draft just wasn't really connecting for a reader, so for my publisher or my editor. They saw a lot of positives there, and but yeah, definitely a lot of negatives. So it was a long process of the, yeah, like getting that structure right, getting the character journey right, you know, building the world that around Jamie's character and the circumstances he's in. Yeah, really getting the relationships right with the characters. But yeah, I was definitely kind of towards the time... So I submitted the manuscript to my publisher. Boy from the Mish came out. Boy from the Mish did way better than I thought it would, and started getting shortlisted for all these awards. And then we started the editing process for this manuscript, and I started to get really worried that this book wasn't going to be as good, or it wasn't going to be as marketable, or, you know, no one will want to read this because it's not about the gay Aboriginal kid, this one. So yeah, there were those kinds of doubts that set in, and they continued right till the book was published and beyond. I feel like I've really only recently come past that kind of fear and that doubt.
One thing you do exceptionally well is those relationships and between the characters, and the fact that there's a real not a sense of good and bad in this book. So We Didn't Think It Through begins with a scene with a group of friends, Aboriginal boys, stealing a car. Now, that struck me immediately as a stereotype, but then from there you just pick it apart and dismantle it, and we're totally with Jamie as he is, you know, one mistake, one bad choice, bit of peer pressure, and he's suddenly in juvenile, and we're with him as he navigates a system that is already against him and that could turn him out to be, you know, a good kid into a bad kid. I found that really fascinating, the way you pulled it apart after that, and I love Jamie. How you work in the juvenile justice system, how do you think it's failing young Indigenous people?
Well, that's a big question. I think, you know, from my experience, and the reason the character started growing in my head and the reason I wanted to write that story was because I was spending a lot of time with these Aboriginal boys in the juvie, and there are all these kind of recurring themes that were coming up with each of them. And there's a siren going to kill my monologue. It's a police car. All right, so... I began to notice...
just for you.
Yeah, I began to notice kind of these... A lot of the boys that I was working with all had very similar upbringings. Like, they all came from broken families, or they all... Or, you know, some of them had been removed from their parents at a young age and had grown up in care. A lot of them had, you know, mental health issues, undiagnosed learning difficulties and learning delays and intellectual disabilities. And the amount of support I could actually provide as a youth worker was so limited that there were, you know, there was no real avenue for them to get that actual meaningful support that they needed. There were a few youth workers that worked in the juvie who did a really good job to try and, you know, get things in place for them when they release, but, you know, as soon as they leave the juvie, then that support finishes. So there were a lot of kind of... And there were also a lot of... there was a lot of representation of Aboriginal kids in the juvie. So I think at one point at the juvie I was at was... Like, the percentage of Aboriginal kids was like 40% or something like that. And there was just like a constant, like, churning, revolving door. You know, I'd see one kid, he'd leave And 7 months later, I'd see him come back, and he'd be changed in some way, or he'd be exactly the same. There's one kid I worked with for 3 years. And there was just so many moments that, you know, from our conversations and from seeing the way the other supports that were meant to be around him, you know, in addition to the support I was providing, were, the support would just stop once he got to a certain level.
Yeah.
And there was that continuous support just wasn't there. And the support that was being set up was, you know, all kind of band-aid fixes. Mm. I guess, you know, for the kids that get removed from their parents and have ended up in juvie, I think there's this whole system that, you know, the kids are removed because they're in danger or because they need to be protected, and then they go into the system and they're not protected anymore.
Mm.
And it just feels like the protection is very limited. I got very angry and passionate about that for a while. And
yeah.
I had this character growing in my head, and I got that book deal and then decided that I just need to sit down and write it. Yeah.
And in some ways, I think literature can do a lot in terms of just opening up conversations and at least get us thinking about what's working and what's not, because you see the front page about, the youth crime at the moment just escalating, and everyone gets angry and furious and points the finger. It's the parents, it's the system, it's this, it's that, and it's a lot of things, isn't it? It's complicated, is what it is.
Yeah, and I think the biggest issue I saw was, these kids weren't looked at as human beings. They were the criminals or the delinquents. They were the people who'd made bad decisions or done this really wrong thing.
One bad decision. All.
Yeah. But, you know, actually spending time with the kids and getting to know all the different domains of their lives. The thing that struck me the most was their resilience and the way, you know, their sense of humor never faded with the circumstances they were in. And that was really the kind of the main message I wanted my readers to have from that book, was that Aboriginal kids are resilient, and, you know, they're very, takes a lot to knock someone down. I don't know. I was about to say something else, but I won't.
Were you going to drop the F-bomb?
No.
We had a discussion earlier who was going to do that first accidentally, but so far we've been really good,
yes,
haven't we?
Yes, we have.
Yeah.
Very appropriate.
I think it's difficult enough to break into publishing right now for anybody. It's a tough landscape out there. It's been more traditionally more difficult for marginalised voices or people whose stories we haven't heard before. Do you think there's been any barriers to your success? Because it seems to me at the moment that we're finally getting some stories out there that should have been told a long time ago. Are you happy with the way things are going?
Yeah, definitely. I think the biggest barriers I saw were I didn't have access to any books that were written by Aboriginal authors when I was a kid. The books we studied in class were never written by Aboriginal authors. They were never Aboriginal YA books. The stories that did have Aboriginal characters in them were, you know, those characters were very stereotyped, and they were the comedic effect in the story. The old wise Aboriginal elder that drops the advice on the protagonist. I think, and also, you know, going into wanting to be a writer as an adult, I began to think that the reason I didn't see those kinds of books was because there was no market for that, or because publishers didn't want to publish books by Aboriginal writers. I even thought that that probably wouldn't happen for me, because I was writing stories about Aboriginal characters. And I wasn't sure if publishers wanted to publish that. But I'm really excited with the way things are going now and the diversity of the voices being published. I do think that Own Voices movement was very, very powerful in the way it's kind of influenced publishers to seek out those stories more. And, writers who wouldn't have been published 20 years ago, I think, are able to get their stories in front of readers these days. I think it's definitely a very positive thing, and I think you can find a book written by an author that, you know, no matter what your ethnicity or, you know, sexual identity, you can find a book that's written by an author that's like you and has a character that's going through exactly what you're going through these days. So.
And a lot of people seem to think that we learn to walk in another's shoes when we're reading books, but it's also important to find ourselves there, to know that we're represented and to know that, you know, literature is for everybody.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
We're going to look for some questions if anyone would like to ask Gary anything about his writing or his books. Don't do this to me, Adelaide. Thank you.
Well, congratulations. I've been volunteering in remote Aboriginal communities for a long time, and I do know something about what goes on. And what I'm just to expose it and to have a publisher to expose your stories is so important. And I'm just wondering how the public service in the juvenile area have reacted to this.
Well, I haven't heard from anyone, so I have no idea. I do think, yeah, the thing I've realised recently is that there needs to be more involvement and communication between, you know, community organisations and the juvies. Particularly, I'm, you know, speaking for Western Sydney, where I've seen that downfall, but I haven't actually heard from anyone who works in that area or any organisations. Or seen any changes, no. Yeah, I don't know. Time will tell, I guess. Yeah.
It's probably a good opportunity for some people in power to read young adult literature as well and not write it off as being something for kids. It's
something
for all of us. Yeah. Mm. Next question.
I had a sort of craft-based author question. You spoke before about the sort of the self-doubt that comes with writing, and I was wondering if you found anything that sort of helps you when you're experiencing that to kind of keep going with the writing. Is there and with the publicity as well? Do you find there are things you can do to help you manage that kind of anxiety that comes with it?
Good question. I think I'm still figuring that out for the most part, but something I do now is I really try to kind of repeat, you know, the message to myself that the story I'm writing is important, and that's something that I really care about. And so it's important that I get it published or I finish that draft. Yeah, I don't really. Apart from that, like, it's just about, like reading other books and finding that inspiration again and. But yeah, I don't really have a great answer for how I deal with self-doubt. I guess, you know, it's kind of in a way the same thing, but like public speaking was something that terrified me 2 years ago, 3 years ago. You know, I used to get massive anxiety before walking on stage, but now before I come on, if I feel myself getting a bit nervous, I just remind myself that we're talking about my books and I love that I wrote these books and I think that they're really important to me, and I'm the expert on it, so because I wrote it. So just reminding myself of that, I think, gets me through them. But yeah, as for self-doubt, I'm not really sure. I don't have a great answer yet. What about you, Vicky?
I think you just have to live with it like a evil twin in the
cellar. Yeah. Yeah, I've come to accept that it's just going to be a part of the experience, I guess. And once you do that, you kind of take away its power in a way. But yeah, it's always going to be there, really.
Absolutely. Another question?
Gary, I'd like to thank you for your bravery and your courage and your patience with publishers who thought they were stepping out of the comfort zone. Both your books excite me tremendously. I've written tons of notes here about it being very terrifying and the weight. And for young Aboriginal people to have access to Aboriginal writers and telling their own stories. And I think a few people have touched on access, and I wonder Sorry, I also have to say how personal the stories are and how real that makes them. And you've just said you're the expert on your stories, and that couldn't be truer. I'm wondering if there's anything we can do, as, and I imagine there are teachers in the audience, to get your books out and to get feedback to you about what young people think about your writing. And if you don't have suggestions about that, because that's an enormous question, you could let us all know, because I know you've got a blog.
Yes, I do. that is an enormous question. I think just for an Aboriginal kid, I think just knowing that the stories exist, I don't know about anyone else, but I always found the stories I was forced to read in class, like I just automatically hated them. So, you know, being encouraged to seek out stories that you find interesting. Just having them around, like having a First Nations literacy section or, you know, Aboriginal book section in the library, encouraging the kids to go and see them and to just read the covers, read the blurbs on the back covers. You can't put a book in someone's hand.
The covers are really good.
Oh, well, thank you. You can't force someone to read something they don't want to read, I think, unless they're in English class. I guess just knowing that they exist and knowing that they're in my school library, I feel like that would have made the difference for me if I knew that there was a section of the library where there were queer books and where there were First Nations books. I think that would have made a massive difference for me. Thank you for your question.
Thank you. Next
hey, Gary.
Question.
My name's Dominic. I'm Nadanjeti Garnafoa. I'm also queer, and so I wanted to thank you for writing these books, because I wish that, I think I'm a few years older than you, but I wish I had these books growing up and having that kind of representation. But I wanted to ask you about, you kind of touched on it a little bit about going into libraries and having books that represent yourself there, but how do you feel now being that Aboriginal writer who is filling that kind of space with these important queer Aboriginal stories?
it's a little bit scary, but at the same time, I don't know how much I believe in, like, everything happens for a reason, but I do feel like writing is my purpose, and so I'm kind of fulfilling it by writing my stories. And there was an Aboriginal kid who was 17 and sent me a message on Instagram and, you know, saying that my book helped him to come out and, changed his life. And that kind of blew me away, and I didn't know how to reply, and I actually didn't reply for about a week because I was thinking about it the whole time. That's the power that books have, and I kind of think that if I write a book that just one person can be impacted positively by, then that's all that I really want to do. I write my books. You know, my first book I wrote specifically for me, teenage me, and who would have really loved to have a book like that, I think. So to know that it's reached someone else that was probably in the same position that I was in, struggling to accept who you are and really needed that kind of encouragement, and just to know that you're not the only person going through what you're going through. I think that's something that really kind of motivates me to continue writing stories. So in summary, it does feel terrifying sometimes to know that all these people I'll never meet are reading stories that I'd written, but at the same time, I'm also really happy that I get to have that impact on someone's life. I think that's a really, really massive privilege, and I don't take it lightly. Yeah.
Thank you. Time for another one.
Gary, I'm assuming that encouraging teacher made a significant impact on you, and I'm curious to know whether you sent a copy of your first book to her. But more generally, knowing a few young people who would like to write, apart from encouraging teachers, what, to both of you, looking back, would have supported you to become the authors you've become? Like, how can we support young people to write?
I would love to see less focus on the rules and more on... I think you have to find those kids that really aren't sure of themselves and make sure that they're supported, because I was pretty quiet about loving to read and write because I got picked on for doing it. So, you know, I was quiet about it. I needed someone to come and find me and say, hey, you're good at this. Unfortunately, it came a bit late for me. I had to figure it out a lot later in life. I can see that it's happened sooner for Gary, and I'm really grateful for that, because, you know, we got your books a lot sooner, since you weren't left to figure it out sort of by yourself. You need those teachers. I did have one of those teachers, I have to say, but I think I was too busy dodging. I was too busy surviving and trying to fit in than I was worrying about my own ambition at that time.
Yeah, I think, yeah, exactly what you said, but I also add, you know, make reading fun. Like, the books I found fun when I was a kid were like Captain Underpants and Andy Griffith's books. And I think also another really important thing is to start them reading early. I think once you get to teenage years, it's really hard to get into reading if it's never been a part of your life before. But yeah, I think just the fun of it, you know, read books that are interesting to you. I'm sorry, I feel like I forgot what your question actually was.
The question really was about not so much reading, but for a kid who has talent in writing.
Oh, yeah.
How do you, beyond having a good teacher, which, well, you had a good teacher who encouraged you, but that doesn't always happen. What can we be doing as a society that wants our young people to do well? What should we be doing to encourage latent writers like yourself to come forward and have a go at it?
Yeah, I think I was very much a quiet achiever at school. That was what they all wrote on my report cards. So I think it was really easy for me to slide under the radar. But I just had a teacher who noticed. So I think more than anything, it's just noticing what the young people are interested in. Those words of encouragement, like, they weren't massive kind of conversations we had. They were little comments here and there that really kind of began to feed something in me. Just knowing that someone noticed that I was enjoying writing, I think, was the biggest thing. I think writing is so fun as well. And I love writing because it's also therapy for me, which I'm sure it is for you, for Kate, for Vicky as well. So writing doesn't have to be writing stories. It can be writing about, you know, what happened. And I really find that helps me to process things if I just write it down. It's a big question.
And teachers are up against a lot at the moment. Like, there's just so much just distraction, and trying to get kids hooked on books is maybe too singular a focus. Just getting them hooked on stories and tying that in with their interests, like movies, music, film, slam poetry, whatever it takes to get them interested in using words to express.
Yeah, and one of the big things for me in my teen years was my mum was, she was not a massive reader, but she liked to read books of movies, like movies that were made. She liked to read the book version of it. So that kind of interested me, wanting to see, because she used to always say the book is better. So it kind of made me want to read those books that were made into movies. I don't really know where I was going with that, but I said it.
That's okay. We're all falling apart right about now. And I think we're out of time anyway. So, but I just want to say to Gary that, you know, two beautiful books. Is there another one on the way?
There is another one coming in September.
September.
So it's called I'm Not Really Here, and I don't know how to talk about it yet.
I don't jinx it. You put the hoodoo on the book. But The Boy from the Mish, and we didn't think it through. Like, two beautiful books, and we're very glad to have you on the writing scene. Glad that you found your way through the labyrinth, and looking forward to another book from Gary in September. Can we thank Gary for coming to Adelaide and talking?
Thank you.
And thank you all for hanging around. This is, I think, our first evening session this late, and I think it's pretty cool to be sitting here in the dark and talking about books. It's been great. So thank you all. Thanks for coming.